You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I want to introduce Professor Johannes Wilden from Norwich University, and he was part of a program, a grant that we gave to a group in Washington State who did a project on prison debates at the Coyote Ridge Correctional Center in collaboration with, was it Walla Walla Community College?
Yeah.
Walla Walla Community College. And it was a really innovative project for what was then the Youth Initiative, because it took us out of the realm of traditional competitive debate into debate that had a larger purpose. And the Human Rights Initiative, where Haider and I are now working, is exploring how this methodology might be able to be used in fulfilling their strategy, and how we might be able to take the methodology that Johannes has developed and apply it in the contexts and geographies that we're working in. So I'll turn it over to Johannes.
Thank you, Kimberly, and thank you all for coming. It's delightful to be here at the Mothership. As you'll find out, I've done a variety of kinds of work, and it's fantastic that you're interested enough in it that I can try and show some of what I've been doing and the direction that I'm going. So very briefly, I'm an assistant professor, first year on the tenure track at Norwich University, small liberal arts college in northern Vermont, central Vermont. I worked in Latvia after getting my master's degree at the University of Durham. And I'll tell you a little bit about my experience there working to develop the first probation service in that country. Most recently, I worked in the prison in Eastern Washington State. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the things I learned there and why I think the method that we've developed in partnership with correctional educators, with students, has value and import beyond maybe just building debate capacity. So the first thing I need to do is, well, I don't think I need to make the point about why debate's important or why respectful disagreement's important. I think I would say that we're in this time right now where we have these very cynical views of what information is or should be from talk radio and certain so-called news channels. On the one side, and on the other, we have the satirical look that's often mocking, and I enjoy that. I mean, for example, I think what John Oliver's doing right now is utterly brilliant, but it seems to me it leaves or it closed the door for the opportunity to have a more meaningful discussion. If we're in the middle of mock outrage on the one hand, or simply making fun of people on the other, there's no middle ground, it seems to me. And I want to return to thinking about some of those things. The first thing I need to do, and I always feel a little guilty doing this, but I need to be critical of traditional debate models. And there's lots here to be critical of, but let me just say, there are a lot of really good people doing really good work. And anytime you're inspiring students to research and speak and consider counter evidence and other views, you're doing a good thing. But my concern right now with forensic competitive debate, especially as it's practiced in this country, is that we turn everything into a competition to be judged. And we miss out on the broader potential for people of diverse perspectives coming together and thinking through a contentious and difficult issue. So this is a quote from a Wired magazine that did a bit of an expose on debate. The point is that young people are getting trained to speak as fast as possible, because the more information you get out, the higher you will score. Doesn't matter the quality, just the more is better. Well, that's limited, I think, in some important ways. I also think the thing that frustrated me is when I looked at some of these texts, you really got the sense that what mattered was how much information. And the quality of the information was less important than how you presented it, how you dressed it up. And if you think about our current debate and political debates, when we watch these things, if we're brave enough to do so, the misrepresentations are just enormous, and the focus on actual evidence is scant. How can you sell a position? How can you market a political vision? It's irrelevant to whether that information is accurate or not. So again, I think it's important to say that while I'm critical of traditional models of debate, I think it's important that we recognize that good work is being done. But I just think that the model at present is limited, and it's limited by the competitive impulse to win. Right now, forensic debate, so-called, rewards argumentation skills, cross-examination, speed speaking. Indeed, some of these manuals, if you read them, they talk about you're not trying to prove one position, you're trying to destroy the other one. Well, that doesn't leave very much room for cooperation or consensus or respect. I truly believe if debate's seen as a winner-take-all proposition, then we're missing the point. We're missing the value that may be there. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about my experience both in Latvia and in Washington State, and talk about, in a macro sense, the sort of values and principles that I think came out of that, those experiences. So I was just an intern. I had just finished my master's in international law, European legal studies at the University of Durham. I was all set to go to Brussels. I had a job lined up, and I went there, and there were these incredibly beautiful people, male and female, who all spoke 4, 5, 6 languages. And I was like, what in the world am I going to do here? I don't know anything about this. I can't. Just at that time, someone forwarded me an email that the Canadian International Development Agency was funding internships all over the world to support their Convention on the Rights of the Child reporting. And so I ended up applying and was accepted and went to Latvia, ostensibly to work with the Center for Children's Rights in Riga, and eventually got brought into this large-scale justice reform project that was funded by the Canadian government in cooperation with the World Bank and Soros Funds Latvia. So I know we like outputs and outcomes, so just we're all clear, we ticked all the boxes. The most important work that I saw was the personal and the interactions between individuals, and watching. What was neat about the model is that we invested in pilot projects and communities first, before the central government was ready to really move. And then as those pilot projects demonstrated success, we were able to come to the Ministry of Justice or Prison Administration and say, these are what we have going on. How do you think we should proceed? And the result eventually was a probation working group, and eventually a set of laws and amendments that gave probation legal effect. And then the probation service was established in 2003. It still exists, despite the economic downturn. It hasn't been subsumed by prison administration, which is a big deal in terms of orientation, philosophically and practically. So the headlines, reduced prison populations, expanded community corrections, and again, a standalone probation agency based in communities. I feel strongly that probation agencies should be based in the community and not the court. Simply because when you base it in the community, the natural tendency is to build community resources. And so you're able to not direct everything out of the courthouse, but you can build volunteer activities, mentorship, and that was some of the things that worked in our most successful regions in Latvia. Just a reminder of some of the situation. As part of Latvia's accession to the EU, there were a number of human rights reports, and the conditions of the prisons were routinely addressed. They made every report, I think, from 97 through 2001, high rates of TB, Hep C, very little support. I write about a little bit in my book the first time I went to what was called the best prison in Latvia, and I was with I was with my mentor, actually, Dr. Liz Elliott, who's passed away. But at one point, she wanted to leave. She was like, "We got to get out of here. I can't be here anymore." And I was like, "You wanted to come. We are here now. We are going. We're going to see this." And it was awful. If I never have to tour another prison again, that would be fine with me. Ironically, I ended up working in one for 4 years. But in terms of what mattered in the Latvia Project, and I've written about this in a number of contexts and articles and in a book, but really what mattered was relationships. And the way that relationships were established were through interactions in which you could break down these expert-learner dichotomies and you could really get into the normative differences that sometimes remain hidden. One of the challenges in Latvia was that some of the community folks that we had brought to the training wouldn't speak until the government folks had spoken. And one of the challenges was being able to get a real sense of where people were at and what they thought were possible. One of the neat things that I saw work was the application of restorative justice principles. And even things like starting and ending a training session with a circle really broke down some of those hidden, I think, sometimes impediments to real reform. That's one of our training groups. The big thing, again, was mutual respect and getting the sense that we didn't have an all-knowing expert who was lecturing at a know-nothing learner. And part of that was we got lucky with the Canadians that we brought over. They just were good in a way that others weren't. And I've written about this. I conducted a number of interviews, 50 interviews over 3 years, to really try to understand what happened in Latvia. And this was something that came back again and again and again, and building relationships and why. And the thing was, the top quote, we had to participate in sometimes strange activities, but it was okay, it was good. And the reason it was okay and it was good is because people felt safe within the training session. And that can be challenging, especially when you're talking about criminal justice and human rights and assumptions that people have about what is and what isn't valuable. What I took from Latvia, what my experience really showed me, was that you have to find ways to bridge the theory-practice problem. People need to personally experience and reflect upon the underlying values at issue. And change is only possible once people start to challenge, let's say, once they start to identify, first of all, their own unconscious bias and are given an opportunity to grow beyond it. And it sounds very, very simple, I realize. But the impact, I would argue, is profound. So I finished my programming. I went to work in Ottawa at AUCC. I ran a number of projects in Africa, Southeast Asia, in the Philippines, in Bangladesh. And then I decided to go do a PhD, and I wrote about my experience in Latvia. I ended up getting a job at George Mason University, running their internship program, and then headed out west. My wife at that time got a position at Coyote Ridge. She was the medical director, and she took a 500-bed facility to the largest prison in the Pacific Northwest. I think it's at 2,500 right now. And that was an incredible experience for her. I was the tag-along, and we were introduced to people, and there was an opportunity to go and teach in their college program in Walla Walla Community College. And I had tried to get into the prisons when I was doing my PhD up in Vancouver, and had no luck at all. And here were people within the prison saying, "Hey, come teach for us." So really, this debate program is the result of teaching there and being challenged in a way I'd never been challenged before. Sometimes people assume that incarcerated individuals aren't intelligent or don't know things. That was not my experience. My students read everything they were given. They came in with question after question. Well, what about this? The big thing is they all wanted to argue with me. at first that was a challenge because, you know, I'm all knowing and I'm the one that's paying me to be here and you guys don't know anything. I had to quickly move beyond that because it wasn't going anywhere. But what I realized, if I could harness that desire to argue to some pedagogical purpose, we could use that time in a more valuable way. So, as some of you know, we were able to get a grant through OSF, and Walla Walla Community College taught the program in the prison. We had partners with Washington State University who brought students in, and Coyote Ridge Correctional Center, believe it or not, were really amenable. This was our biggest question. Would the prison say yes? And I had doubts all along, but the superintendent there really saw the value of it and got behind it early and continued. So now I'm going to, in a second, present a little video, but I just want to give you a little background to what the model is and why is this debate model any different from traditional models? And I would say there are four big differences. The first is you accept responsibility to abide by the principles of the model, and that means respectful discourse. That is the minimum standard before you can participate. You have to say, yes, I agree to abide by these principles. There's a commitment to using scholarly sources, not whatever could be Googled the night before. Scholarly sources. You also agree to potentially have to argue a side of an issue that you don't personally agree with. This isn't a well-worn technique used in liberal arts colleges all around. As soon as you make a statement that you feel very strongly about capital punishment or abortion or some other contentious issue, some smarmy college prof somewhere will say, okay, great, write your term paper on the other side of the argument. That's what these guys had to do as part of this program. You didn't know what side of the debate you were going to get, so you had to prepare both sides. The final thing, and I really think this is the most important thing, is embracing humility. Embracing the idea that you might be wrong. I know it's an unlikely possibility. I know we're all very, very smart, but there is a small chance that you might be mistaken. And so as part of the model, you have to acknowledge the best argument on the other side before you conclude your case. So this one, the documentary is called The Walls. It won a special jury prize for the Social Impact Media Awards. It was great to work with Gonzalo and Nacho. It was really neat to see the project through somebody else's eyes, especially when you're so close to it. And, you know, it was really neat to watch what they watched. So it's a 14-minute video. I don't think we'll watch the whole thing today, but if you are interested, it's on YouTube. I'm happy to send out the link.
I was actually 17 because we bought them illegally, but we always had a high regard for human life.
It's nice to see everyone. Is it a little warm? Can someone crack a window? That's the Yeah, so obviously if my career as a practitioner academic works out, I can go on the road as a comedian because that's hilarious. I honestly don't remember saying that. As I said, the video is 14 minutes long, and if you're interested in watching the whole thing, it's on YouTube. It was really neat to be involved with a process in which artists came in and looked at what we did and reimagined it. And it was tough for a control freak like me to be able to like let go. But I think the results speak for itself. I think it was a great project. So what unites these things? How is a justice reform project in Latvia and a prison debate project the same? And I would argue that at the root there are fundamental core values which animate and connect these two ideas. And both of these projects were experiential, creative, contentious, and normative. You couldn't succeed in the training environment unless we had some way of respecting the different communication styles where people were coming from. The trainers who came in felt really strongly about presenting a buffet menu of different options, as opposed to saying, this is the one true way to do it based on my experience in Ontario or Quebec. The big thing is that in both cases, you have facilitators who set the stage and then step away and allow people to figure out for themselves what the next step is. And that, I want to argue, is fundamentally connected to a view of how to do development, whether it's international or domestic. The Latvians spoke about, in my research, this difficulty of staying quiet when they were listening with someone they didn't agree with, and that it was important to realize that they had to. That was in the context of the, you know, the famous talking piece in the circle, right? Whoever has the talking piece has the floor. It's similar to a debate style where whoever's making that two-minute speech, again, has the floor. I think that for some within the training session, they really felt like the learning only happened when they could speak about their own experience. It wasn't the tailored training program of this is what we're going to do today. The Canadian trainers had to have some give and take to make it work. One of the activities we did in the prison was have people, the students, complete surveys about the first time they met their counterparts in the first meeting in the prison. And I just, this quote to me is so telling. It just speaks volumes that it would be, that if you wanna be heard, you have to listen. It's so simple, and yet again, it profound in some way. A lot of people really appreciated that they were equals in the process. So the first meeting, they come in and we say, okay, what are our topics going to be? And we solicit topics and we vote on them. And then the top three topics are listed, and then teams are broken into groups, half Walla Walla Community College students, half Wazoo students, and they need to come up with the best arguments for why we should do that topic. And then they present those arguments, and then we vote again, and then the topic that wins is the topic we use. So that was the, there was no one got to say, well, I'm more important or I'm more this. Everyone had one vote. And as I always said, I get to vote too, but my vote is not worth more than anybody else's. The final thing I want to try and do is anchor those principles in one view anyway, of human rights and theory of practice and how that makes sense in a programming point of view. When I was doing my master's degree, I had a great law prof who was a big bear of a guy with like a grizzly hair and would always sort of growl and bark at us in that British way that only, I don't know, to me there's always this, I have a strong memory of this particular point, and he would say, what's the most important human right? And everyone would say, the right to life, not to be tortured, right to speech. And he would say, nonsense. If we don't respect people's rights equally, none of them matter. If you can say we're going to treat this category of people differently, then none of those rights mean anything. And his point was always that if you look at international documents, if you look at the European Convention on Human Rights, equality, an equality of recognition of rights is one of the most important. I don't want to get too academic-y, but I want to point out one thing that I really like about the OSF model of programming, and that is what Paul Knepper calls the distinction between the evidence-based model and the reflexive model. The evidence-based model, of course, is drawn from medicine. It's the idea that we can, if we have a large enough sample, conduct experiments to find out generalized truths that can be applied everywhere equally. The reflexive model is one that Knepper associates with OSI, and it's the idea that it's essential that we create space for people to figure out for themselves what works, and that process of social interaction and tinkering is actually what creates sustainable reform. What's interesting to me about these models is both of them consider equality, but from very different perspectives. The evidence-based model says we're all equal, therefore a tested program should apply equally to everyone because we're all equal. The reflexive model says, yes, we're all equal, but that means that we need to respect the differences that exist regionally, culturally, temporally, and that we need to make space for people to take the time to figure out what they want to do on their own. Another way to look at these projects is through the lens of moral development and psychology. And essentially, this is the idea that I think a lot of the quotes bring out, that part of being able to develop as an individual is being able to see that you might be wrong, to be able to see the flaws in your own argument, to be able to recognize that equality means extending respect to people that you don't agree with, in fact, that you vehemently disagree with. For me, this debate model is an opportunity for people to come into an environment, commit to a process of respectful dialogue, and then engage contentiously around a question. The result being maybe not the answer to all the world's problems, but in that moment, the best and most justified argument is made. And I think there's value in that. There's value in these contingent truth claims that get made by individuals who are working together toward a common purpose. So I know it's death by PowerPoint, and I want to wrap up here pretty quickly, but I want to show you just how I think D3, or diagramic debate and dialogue, can be applied in other settings. The first, I hope, is obvious. We could simply use debates and building debate capacity to help people participate in policy debates. And this would be focused on marginalized populations. It would focus on the traditional tools of debate about identifying and engaging arguments, preparing them, speaking them, acknowledging counter-evidence. There's lots of places in which it could work. I've worked in schools and universities and prisons, but there's no reason that organizations can't adopt these sort of principles to figure out strategically where they want to go. The goal, of course, is that people better understand and can participate in the debates that shape and influence their lives. I hope that's a pretty fairly straightforward application of what could be done here. But I want to encourage us to think a little bit broader about how these things might work. What I'm talking about really recasts technical expertise. It's not about me saying, I'm the expert, I know it all. Now, if you want to adopt my program, you have to do it. It's about me saying, here are two leading views. What do you think? Here's the best evidence I can find for the view that I'm partial to, and yet I'm going to acknowledge the best counter-argument to the view that I think matters. Now, what do you think? It becomes collaborative in that way. I also think this approach expands the idea of experiential learning. You're creating environments for people to disagree. The trick is they may be arguing something they totally don't agree with, but in that moment, they're participating in a process. And again, the most important thing is that it embraces humility. We are not humble. America, if you think of America, do you think is humble, is modesty the first word that comes to your mind? Maybe not. But I think we would do better just to be a little bit more aware of the fact that we don't know what the right answer is. We're doing the best that we can based on the best information that we have. The final thing is that I think integrating these principles can assist project management and project strategy. So I really think investing in people first and projects later is a valuable way to think about this. Who's best able to model these sort of values? Who's best able to engage? I also think that, you know, balancing the what works perspective, the evidence-based perspective, with the reflexive model, the need for local ownership, is forever a tension in any grant-making organization that's doing work, because there will always be a tendency to try to account for change. But the problem is that most of these results-based accountability or results-based management are defined in ways that don't allow for local creativity. And so there's a tension there that I think integrating these principles might be able to, if not resolve, better frame. Finally, this RBA framework, how much, how good is anyone better off? This is the new language of evaluation. I am skeptical about some aspects of evaluation, but overall, we have to find ways to be able to show what it is that we're doing and how it is that we're impacting real people. And so, again, that tension between what we prioritize, what outcomes matter. So just to conclude, I really think debate models can succeed when they embrace the underlying values of human rights. And this is more than civic engagement. It's more than teaching people to make better sense of arguments and participate in policy debates. It's also about recognizing the value of people you disagree with and engaging in a process in which controversy is okay, but humility is always prized. Where am I going with all this? Very briefly, we were lucky enough to obtain a little bit of additional funding for next year. The Washington State Prison Debate Program will continue. There are plans to do a debate again next year. I think it'll have to be in the spring, based on how my understanding is currently. What I'm going to try and do up in Vermont is build networks with the correctional facilities there and target incarcerated veterans. For me, debate is simply a means to connect different populations. There's lots of great things about the potential for debate, but really what you're trying to do is bring different populations together to have more meaningful conversations. And if the debate is a model to do that, so be it. I want to also just tell you a little bit about my current research, which I hope is going to shed some light on what's happening within this debate project. Michael Sandel, I don't know if anybody watches his PBS, but he has a justice program that periodically they show, most popular course at Harvard, and really it's a philosophy of justice course. He presents four theories. What I've done is established a survey and establish a baseline among the students and then looked at how students' perspectives change after using this debate model and Michael Sandel's readings on those four perspectives. I don't have any results to report today, but what's neat about it is by getting a database of views on questions like this, students can do more interesting things. One of my students right now is doing documentary photography and combining pictures of people at various positions through the Corps of Cadets at the university with these quotes on justice to try and have a better and deeper explanation of rights. So what I'm hoping is if there is interest, we can attempt to do a little debate. But before we do that, I wonder if there are any questions or comments. Yes?
Were there any incentives that were given to the inmates?
Debate certificates of participation?
Or what was their incentive to join? Was there a...
Just to do it. In fact, the debate club existed before we knew that we'd be bringing students in from the outside. So this was a way for students who had graduated with their Associate of Arts. What happened at Coyote Ridge is once you had graduated with your AA, you couldn't go back to school anymore. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of guys just sitting on their hands who now have been exposed to higher education, and they're hungry, they want more, but there's nothing to do.
Okay.
So I created the debate club to give them something to do. Okay. So once a week, I went in on Wednesday nights, and we would talk about stuff, and we'd have a debate every week, and that was a way to keep them connected. And then we had the opportunity to bring students in to do stuff, and of course, mm-hmm. membership spiked, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no incentive in the traditional sense.
And the students weren't taking it for coursework, they were just volunteers?
They were volunteers, yeah. I integrated I developed the model out of my coursework,
right.
But it wasn't as part of any additional coursework.
Did you find any relationship that continued after the program ended between the students and the inmates at all, or was there any, were you able to kind of track it a little bit or follow it up?
One of the things that we had to agree to was that the students and the incarcerated individuals would not stay in touch afterward.
That was
a big deal for DOC staff, and that was a promise that we made and had the students make that same commitment. I can tell you that through this video, some of the individuals who were featured are now eligible for early release under a new program Washington State has put forward. If you were tried as an adult when you were a juvenile and you served half of your sentence and you've made satisfactory progress, whatever that means, you could be released. And so some of the individuals who were featured in this video are eligible now for that, and in fact are using this video as a way to say, look, see what I can do. I'm not a wasted human being. I have things to do and contribute.
Right. Okay.
This facility, maximum security facility.
Medium security.
Medium security facility. Yeah. Okay, so that's a big difference.
Certainly. There's only one max in Washington State.
Okay. To piggyback on Ellen, if it was a max, I would say the incentive then would be just to get out of the cell.
Yes, so, I totally agree.
Yeah, so there's always some kind of trade-off, especially when you're talking about prisons.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And one of the things that some prison programs, there's one, I believe, out in San Quentin about, or I'm not sure where it's based, San Francisco, outside, I'm not sure, but there was an attempt, and this is part of a program called College Behind Bars or University Behind Bars, and they work with people who are in for life. Mm-hmm. And we felt very strongly that we wanted to work with populations that were going to be getting out within the next 5 years. Okay. The idea being that if you can identify these folks through internal programming and then connect transition programming and reentry programming, you're giving them much better start not to come back. Now, you could make the argument that from a harm reduction point of view or from a humane point of view, that the folks that really deserve interaction are the ones that don't see anybody. Mm-hmm. But I'm comfortable with the choice that was made there to work with people that are getting out and to really focus on building those skills to help them succeed once they...
I was interested in seeing prison staff, a social worker or a probation officer in Latvia.
Yes.
The comment was that they were not used to this type of, they're used to just punishment.
Yeah.
You did the crime, now you have to serve the time and you should be punished. And they weren't comfortable with programs that would help people not come back, So I found that statement quite interesting too, because how would you? I mean, because even in New York, 99% of the people who are in prison are coming home.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you want them to come home? Because they may be your neighbor.
Exactly. Right.
So how do you want them to come home?
Yeah, and I mean, what's fascinating is that view is not exactly unique to Latvia, right? We have a lot of people who are lock them up and throw away the key, and it's a very emotional and for some people, reasonable, if they're a victim of a crime,
right.
Initial reaction. But it doesn't take you very long to realize that that's not much of a solution. And we've been experimenting with mass incarceration for 25 years. And the news flash, in case anybody was wondering, it was a failure. It did not work at all. It made everything worse. We've lost an entire generation from having incarcerated parents and who are growing up with that same challenge. And so... what's interesting for me about the prison work is finding a way to draw those commonalities and breaking down the walls, which is the title of the film.
Can I ask when you look at the groups that you were engaging in the debate process, so both the students and the prisoners, I mean, did you see a sense of... So did the students come in with a set of biases that were undone? Do you see the prisoners come in with a process with a set of biases undone? And can you talk us through what that looked like and what the kind of time frame is to expect something like that to happen?
Oh, that's a great question. There's a PhD student named Amber Morchek at Washington State University, and she's looking at some of this stuff because she was the Wazoo connection on main campus. I was based at the prison, so I didn't spend a lot of time on main campus. So she's done work around surveying. I think she wants to do this last group, and then look at changes between groups and times, and connect that to the topics, because each topic was very different. One was gun control, one was trying youth as adults, and each of them have their own dynamics. I think, you know, I have to defer to people who have worked in this area for a lot longer than I did, but Loretta Taylor, who's the education director, said this amazing thing. I think was it at dinner? It might have been at dinner the night before the second debate. And she was like, in 20 years of this work, I've never been involved in something that's more interesting. The change that she saw in the guys, in the students that were incarcerated, she said was amazing. And she told this story about one of the male students was talking to some of the guys, and they said, you know, it's really good about it's really good. I've really changed my perspective on who's incarcerated and why, and you know, and I'm hoping to go into law enforcement, and I really hope I can bring that to the table. And one of the guys incarcerated went and found her the next day, and he said, "I've been up all night. You need to tell that guy that not all prisoners are nice." Here was someone incarcerated for 25 years who was telling a free student, "Hey, look, some of these guys aren't real good." That just blew her away. That someone would make that leap. In terms of hard numbers, do we see changes? I can't tell you. The big problem is, and this is why I developed this justice survey, is that I don't know how you measure. I don't know how you measure justice. Hmm. And one of the things I've tried to do is use this Sandel stuff to at least be able to get a sense of whether somebody is more utilitarian, more libertarian, more egalitarian, or more just deserves civic virtue. And then look before an intervention and then afterward to see if any change happened. Because if we're doing this work and people come in with a set of views that never change, then I think you say, well, we may be doing great stuff around bringing different groups together, but ultimately we're not having an impact. But if you can show that, people are moving in orientation from one view to another and are challenging themselves and thinking differently, then I think you can say, in addition to the other valuable aspects of this interaction, we're showing meaningful change in how people are conceiving these core concepts. That is an ambitious research program. Luckily, I'm just about as young as I look. No, but I mean that's the question, right? That is the central question. Are we doing things beyond what look great in a video? I would say, anecdotally, from what I've seen, absolutely. I need to be skeptical about projects that I'm involved in, and that means that I need to find other ways to measure and think about that.
Yeah, from the anecdotal perspective, only at this stage. I mean, definitely in terms of the students coming in as well. I mean, I visited one of the tournaments last year and had some time before it started to really talk to some of the students from Washington State. First of all, there were a lot of students who weren't involved in the program currently but had been involved in the previous that would come back, and so I was talking to some of them about how they were taking the experiences into sort of their career choices and into what they were looking at. So there could be some opportunities, I think, to even measure the impact as an educational program, how it's sort of affecting criminal justice students who will be working with these populations in the future, and thinking how do these programs affect sort of their career choices, their programming choices down the line and things like that. Again, it would take a longer time, but I think there are like areas to suss out in terms of that as well.
Yeah. That's a good reminder about the students that came back. I was shocked that so many had chosen to.
Yeah, there were quite a few, and it was interesting to see them interacting and talking with the current students and giving them advice on how to sort of approach it all and things like that. So there was a lot of kind of knowledge share even within their population. So.
And I mean, we wanted the great speech or the knockout response to a question, but for some of those students, just getting up and speaking for 2 minutes was a big deal. I mean, they were in a prison in front of 150 people, and now they were going to speak for 2 minutes. Just that, for some, was pretty profound.
Could you debate the conditions of the prison, or is that off limits?
Good question. We did have some of those suggestions, What we would do is debate stuff like to punish or rehabilitate. So get at some of those ideas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people could argue that we should make the prisons more awful and terrible because that would, of course, deter people. Because when you're committing a crime, the first thing you're thinking about is how good the conditions are going to be in a prison. It's nonsense. But that is a possible argument that could be made. And the other thing that happened in the prison is some people would say, okay, well, you know, I got into a beef with a CO and I used my debate skill, and I'd be like, okay, I appreciate that, you know, that's one of the things that's happening here. Ultimately, for the success of the program.
I'd like to be invited back.
But those things do happen, right? They definitely happen. For a lot of them, it was just the idea that you could argue, that you could come in with one view and leave with a different view, and that was okay. And one of the things about prison is that you have to be very careful about appearing weak. And adopting another position could be seen as some people as a weakness. Most of us would consider that to be a strength, that you could change your perspective, but that's not necessarily always the case. That was the thing that one of the students said. He talked to me the next week, and I was like, you know, I didn't like how the audience voted. And I was like, oh well, you know, that's how it goes. The audience votes. It doesn't mean that they're right. It just means that that was their view on the day. And he was like, yeah, me and my cellmates talked about it for 3.5 hours. And then someone said, this is what Wieldham was trying to do the whole time. So there was a cognitive recognition that, look, the result of the debate, that didn't solve the problem of what to do with juveniles that commit heinous crimes. But it allowed people to voice different perspectives and think about it in a different way. Again, you know, it sounds simple in many ways, but... In my experience, it can be profound.
Dan, I'm just curious. You know, you've talked a lot about this in the context of criminal justice, but you make the proposition at the end of your presentation that this could be taken over to other contexts. I mean, can you elaborate on that? Do you have a sense of what other kinds of contexts you're thinking of where this could be a useful tool?
I think for me, the value of it is that it can be applied in a lot of different ways. So when I write an argument paper, for example, I always create my strongest argument, but then I have to acknowledge the strongest counterargument. And the idea is that as someone who's claiming some knowledge about a topic, my job is not to advance one perspective, but to compare two different perspectives. So when I think about technical expertise, and I don't know enough about how you approach that question, but what I saw a lot of was people that would fly in and stay at the nicest hotel and do a 2-day training session and fly out. And they, you know, the same PowerPoint that they had given the week before. What I'm trying to suggest is that part of the learning is engaging with that audience. So it's less and more important the subject matter, and it's more important the overall method or approach. So, I mean, for me, one of the obvious possible applications would be in situations where people were not having rights respected for a variety of reasons, based on gender, based on ethnicity, based on age, and building that skill set. Not necessarily on one substance area, but building the ability to look at an issue and identify the key arguments. Arguments of fact, which are empirical statements. Arguments of value, which are ethical or moral claims. And arguments of policy, which is what we ought to do about it. And through that process, they become more, not only aware of their rights, but more able to activate them. So in terms of specifics, one of the things that I'm fascinated by is this, and I don't know enough about what's going to happen with the Youth Initiative or the Youth Exchange or how that's all going to work, but it seems like you have this incredible network of people who have done really interesting things. How do you leverage that into other programs? And so one of the ways might be to have programs look at different models and make choices based on what they think would work best in their program. So reframing that choice as a debate of sorts. These are the strengths of this kind of programming. This is the target of this kind of programming. I think really the big takeaway for me is I'm looking for a partnership to advance these ideas. And I don't necessarily have a clear idea of how that should work, partly because I want to encourage people in within the network and within other areas to think through how it might matter to them. I mean, I think it was fascinating. I learned that there's efforts to establish debate programming in Latvia, for example, which is like, to me, is incredibly awesome because I lived in Riga for a year and Chasis and Valmiera and traveled all around and worked with Soros funds on a number of projects there. But to me, the value of this debate is that it changes expectations. The expectation for people participating in this is not I need to advance one argument. It's that I need to make sure that the person claiming expertise can acknowledge counter-evidence. And that's now part of my expectation when people try to convince me of something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm still trying to get my head around how we use it in other areas. So who those people are that we're engaging. I mean, you gave the example of the rights of marginalized groups. You know, I don't think you need to talk to women's rights activists, disability rights activists, or any kind of activist and explain to them what are the arguments about their rights. So it's about how that community then is engaging with other communities to make the case for their rights. So I'm just trying to get my head around who my audience is, how sure. I'm structuring it, but we don't have to take the whole group in this.
But I actually had a thought about that today. I was in a meeting right before coming here with a young man and his mother from Kiev who are working on LGBT rights, and he noted that within their community they're so used to discrimination and oppression that they don't even realize that there can be another, many young people don't realize that there can be another way to look at things or that to actualize their rights, or the way he put it was really interesting. And I was thinking, well, maybe among some groups that are activists, but there are different levels of activists, that doing an exercise, if we all learned how to do it, something like this, at one of these seminars or conferences that we hold and convene, it wouldn't have to be the focus of the whole thing, but make it one exercise and see if we get anything out of it or how we can make those connections. I don't know, that's off the top of my head, but it kind of became a little bit clearer to me when we were talking.
So. I guess one of the ways that I see, I mean, and I think that's really interesting as a possible venue. I mean, speaking to those groups or individuals, I would say, what's the best counter evidence? Okay, you're advancing LGBT rights in Ukraine or Kazakhstan. What's the best argument against what you're trying to do? Until we identify what that best argument is, it seems to me the impediment is unconscious but right in the way. So is there any view that could possibly justify the extension of rights? Well, I've debated same-sex marriage in prisons. In that environment, very traditional norms. And the argument that gets made in the prison anyway is that people aren't ready for it. That's not a very good argument, especially when you look at how fast rights have advanced, same-sex marriage and the recognition anyway of LGBT issues. So I think the power of it comes in acknowledging the counter evidence. I think one of the things that's challenging in some of these circumstances is that we get so locked into our own perspective to advance a particular view or cause that we can't step back and see where the unconscious impediments might be. And that's what I think part of the value of the model is. And by bringing people in who would be willing to conduct such a debate, would be willing to argue against their own view, you're modeling a sort of flexibility that you want to see. You're building a skill set toward the recognition that even those that stand in the way of LGBT rights have a perspective. You don't like it. You may hate it. But it still exists, and it has to be at least acknowledged. Maybe not accommodated always, but acknowledged.
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of add on to this conversation a bit, I mean, one of the things in the work on debate that I was starting to see with methodologies like this, with methodologies like fusing hip-hop and debate, was that this kind of act of like taking different sides on an issue and kind of in encouraging young people or whatever sort of the constituents would be, sort of the passive youth or the passive adult even in that matter, to sort of engage on these issues in a kind of different sort of way, like sometimes even kind of fun sort of way, is part of the strength of it, that there is actually this you know, we talk a lot about tools for engagement, like how do we use the arts to engage, how do we use forensics to engage with people in a kind of more exciting way rather than just reading a paper, in a more live, interactive way. And I think what's interesting about debate is then it grounds that work in a really, like, obvious sort of, like, okay, we're looking at two sides of a critical issue, and in all of the things that you were saying about kind of the value in getting people to kind of look at the other side of the issue, recognize what the strong argument is on that side, so that then they can kind of come back and better construct their evidence to counteract that argument. But so I think there's a link for me somehow in how debate can be used within that and how it's more grounded in that as well.
That's interesting. And the performative aspect of
mm-hmm,
it.
Exactly.
We all want to be...
people like doing it. I mean, that's... And I think other... You know, I've only seen it in the case of youth, so I don't know how it would translate to other audiences, but in terms of youth, and I think Heider could speak to that as well, his work in MENA, how youth somehow... Even youth you wouldn't expect really... find this as this kind of very empowering tool because it's allowing them to have a voice and a space and a public presence. It's not so much about the win, it is about that kind of public space to be listened to.
You have 2 minutes to make the best case you can, mm-hmm. and everyone has to listen to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think just the safety of that space is a big deal. And as you said, a lot of times these conversations do happen, whether it's conversations around ethnic, religious, social, the disagreements, they do happen. All you know, you take a cab anywhere and you'll get in one of these conversations, or you know, you go to the supermarket. But I think a lot of the times it's very unpopular to take a position that does not support the majority. So even if you have these thoughts, you don't have the space to express it. And I think debate, because when you join a team or when you're part of a team you know it's expected, everyone is there expecting you to take this position, then you feel empowered to take it and go all the way with it. And going back to what you were saying, Emily, one of the projects that we do is called Young Arab Voices, which is a debate-based project. In Egypt, there was an incident in southern Egypt in a town where two gay men were caught in a park engaged in a sexual activity and escalated very quickly into them being eventually killed and dragged on the streets, and there were people chanting around them, and it was filmed, and it was playing out in the media. So Young Arab Voices organized a team from Cairo University of young debaters who were members of the project to go down to that town and have a debate with the city council members around violence against LGBT members. And going into the town, they were very concerned because they were escorted by police for their safety, and there were people around at the entrance throwing stones at them and cursing them for even because they knew they were coming in to take that position of the debate. Mm-hmm. And during the debate was not, again, it's about knowing what your wins are. They didn't go in expecting to change the community's mind into accepting, LGBT members, but it was into going and denouncing any violence against them. And after the debate, by the time they were exiting, a lot of the members of the local council told the police that they were actually provide the protection that police is not even needed at that point. I mean, the police stayed, but still you had local council members escort all the students out afterwards. And there was all these follow-up as well. So I think it's context like these where it's providing a platform where it's safe to take a position, and you're expected to take it, and you're empowered to take it, and you're going to have the time and the protection to express it, and the other is going to have the obligation to listen to it and engage with it. whether they agree with it or not. I think it's that about debate is what's different than other types of conversations or dialogues that happen. And it removes a lot of the cultural barriers. And Minna, one of our biggest challenges was that, you know, the youth were not expected to sit in a debate with senior politicians or officials and challenge them as a peer. Like, you know, they were like, how dare you? Who are you to talk back to me like that? Mm-hmm. You know, whether because they're elder and you have to respect the elder, and because they're more senior, because they're more powerful, because mm-hmm. they're more influential. And I think giving providing a space where they both are equal like that, it breaks down a lot of cultural barriers as well.
I was just thinking of Emily's question about applicability of this mm-hmm. methodology, and it got me thinking about a lot of the post-conflict and transition countries where we are working, where you have people who are on different sides of a war and are in one nation and are trying to make sense of the past. Whose history, whose truth, what does justice mean in contexts like this? Mm-hmm. It seems a useful methodology for me, not just in terms of fostering connections, also just mediating power, having a conversation with power, who your duty bearer or rights holder is. Yeah.
I agree, and that the equality in the space from coming to an agreement to participate means that you have to leave a little bit of your traditional authority or whatever at the door, and you're sitting and you're talking, and your voice is no more important than others. What matters is the quality of the justification that you make. And when you turn it to quality of justification, suddenly all kinds of doors open up, because it's you don't necessarily have to be the oldest or the smartest or the person of traditional power. If you have a good argument and you can convince that, you can move audiences. I think the big thing is not to look at it as we're going to have one debate and all the problems are going to be solved, but the idea of a commitment to that as a process, to where people get used to the idea that this should be, it's very Deweyan, John Dewey and the democratic education, the idea that people should be involved in this process in a practical sense, in a real sense. I think one of the challenges that I've seen in some of the human rights stuff is that it stays very abstract. And one of the things that I love about OSF's work is really bringing it to the ground. What does this mean in practice? For whom? When? And what I want to suggest is that debate offers a structured means for people to discover their rights and the power of voicing their views. And properly supported can create the conditions by which people can actively participate in these decisions in another way.
I have a question. When you decided to take the money that you said you had more money to continue in other areas with the debate, you said that you wanted to do incarcerated veterans. Mm-hmm. Was there a specific reason why you chose that population?
Norwich is the oldest private military college in the U.S. It's got an interesting history of very traditional on the one hand and very progressive on another. For me, after spending some time there, I think it would be really valuable for those students to work with incarcerated veterans, partly because the views there, based on my research, are very punitive and very libertarian. And I think there's potential for interesting conversations among the incarcerated veteran population, because they have some commonality. Both of them are focused on service, at least nominally. And I think there's potential for interesting conversations there. I think the big, for me, the big lesson out of Washington State is it takes time to build networks. It takes time to meet the right people and make connections. And so I'm still getting to speed with what's going on with correctional education in New York State, in Massachusetts, in Vermont, and trying to liaise with people who are doing good work currently. Because, you know, without Loretta Taylor at Coyote Ridge, this project wasn't happening. And so it's finding those people who are able to make those connections and facilitate those projects that are really key. So that's where I'm at. I'm at right now.
Did you find a mindset change among the court officers with the debate program, with importing the debate program?
Only anecdotally. Mm-hmm. We didn't survey them per se. It's quite complicated to get through research protocols in the prison, mm-hmm. and we would be looking at numbers of 4 and 5 mm-hmm. or something. So it's it would be sort of very personal. I'm interested in looking at it. That there is a general frustration in the facility because they're offering community college courses, an associate of arts degree, and the COs, most of them have high school education. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
Incarcerated individuals are getting a better education for free than the correctional officers. Mm-hmm. I, at the early days, pitched classes with COs and incarcerated individuals together. Back when I was very naive about how things could work, but there is a natural tension there. But you know, the correctional officer population is like any other. There's good people and there are very, very bad folks in there who make life as bad and miserable as possible.
And had that the impact on gang violence? Did it have any impact at all? Did it heighten it? Did it decrease some of the intra gang violence that might happen in a prison surrounding?
I would have to sort of defer on that question only because we only did it for a year.
Okay.
And certainly you could look at institutional data.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm hoping to do in the future is look at individuals who are involved in the Associate of Arts program and the prison debate program and look at their infraction list before the program and afterward.
Okay.
What the superintendent has told us is that we love the AA program because you settle everybody else down,
mm-hmm.
and that the students actually become mentors in the units themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the case. I mean, after the first debate, we had 25 people who wanted to now be part of the debate club. And I was just like, you know, we'd love to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Is it feasible? Mm-hmm. No. And so we had to sort of come up with a way to manage those numbers. But you know, the mass incarceration problem in this country could be turned into a human resources solution if properly motivated and if properly thought through. But I do think the core principles that are at stake, the applied philosophy, the idea of taking these abstract ideas and making them real and concrete in an experiential way, that's the thing that excites me about the potential for it. And the application, I think there's been some very interesting ideas around the table. I'm hesitant to pitch this is the one way to do it, you know, because the part of the strength of it is that it's malleable, it's flexible, it can be applied depending on how people see it.
It just struck me in the telling that there was something really important about being in the prison system and bringing the students into the prison system and having that exchange, so the experience, right?
Right.
And so some of the other kinds of examples we've talked about, you're not getting that piece of the lived experience there. I was thinking a little bit about in a number of countries where we work on criminal justice in Africa, a piece of that work is really about supporting paralegals to go into the prisons and engage with the prisoners. And they do a lot of theater to help prisoners prepare for defending themselves mm-hmm. in the justice system because there's no lawyers. And I was just wondering, you know, could you also work with those paralegal groups to be thinking about how you could introduce some debate into those prisons? The numbers are challenging because usually it's like all of the prisoners in the courtyard of the prison. So you don't really have 25, you sort of have the prison population all at once. Or at least that's how I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
I don't know but if you all had other kinds of Rosia. I don't know. So I'm just trying to get a handle on the experiential part,
right,
and how you then translate that to maybe other areas where you don't have the prison walls kind of providing that space.
I think anytime you have an us and them, anytime you have this division that at least is partially normative, that puts up blocks toward people working together, there's the potential for having this to maybe not save the day and change everything, but to give people an opportunity to reflect on what they think and why. And what the moral development literature suggests is that when given those opportunities in an experiential way and pro-social way, people do change. They do, of their thinking does evolve. That's what I want to show over the long term here. And so the question becomes, I think you're right, how do we practically apply it? But I think there's ways on the ground at the project level. But I also think there's ways at the program level and the strategy level to be thinking through how it is we value difference, how it is we bring different people together, and why that value of structured debate and the focus on humility is so important.
I agree. I see Emily's point in terms of the actual experience and exposure to someone else's world and what that entails and getting into that mindset. But I think even if you talk about exchanges of people going into populations that are suffering from poverty and going into their worlds, or populations who are very conservative settings or very conservative cultures and going into that world, I don't know if that's similar to what you were referring to in terms of experiencing just this setting, which is part of the mindset and the mentality, and if that can change. One challenge we had with the debate, and now would be curious to see how what kind of models we develop to get around it, is, as you said, it does have all these great benefits. It tends to be very heavy on individual investment, however. Mm-hmm. Even when you're talking now about, a debate team usually is, depending on the model, 3 or 6 people on the team, over the course of working with them for a year or 2 years to potentially maybe change their minds on something, seems a little bit a heavy individual investment. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about resources and choice making, we did find some ways that we could multiply that effect, but I was curious to see how you've experienced that, and what ways have you figured that could widen the impact.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I would combine that with the concern that in order to debate, you need to be able to read, and you need access to information, and you need that ability. So one of the things that we did, and Ricardo Chavez, who was in the video, he teaches in the GED. Program at the prison, and all prisons in the U.S. have GED programs. It's mandated. It's very important. I would argue post-secondary correctional education is more important, but GED stuff is very important. What he did was develop a library of arguments from reputable sources with the proper citations, and then organize them by fact, value, and policy, and then would assign 5 people, for example, are going to take the fact argument, and you need to write a 2-minute speech based on this information. So you're not now reading 100 pages and journal articles. You're now reading maybe 5 pages of summarized material. And that would be for the sort of people who are just beginning to get into this next phase. But we would have more than one person prepare the same type of argument, so that if somebody got cold feet or got thrown into SEG or whatever else happened, someone else could step up. And honestly, the process of going through and reading that material and then making it your own through a 2-minute speech, even if you don't get to give your speech, it's still valuable in the sense that you're articulating your best view. At least in the prison context, that was really, really valuable for them. Does that answer your...
Part of
it, yeah.
I mean, the other part again was about how do you make sure that the benefits and the impacts, all the great things that we mentioned, will not be limited to the members of the debate club who are below 10 perhaps,
sure,
or below 12.
Sure.
But it would reach a wider group.
So in the prison, we had 5. And 5, 3 members from Wazoo, 2 from Walla Walla Community College, 3 from Walla Walla Community, 2 for Wazoo, so mixed teams, and 150
audience
members. And so they make their presentation, it's 50 minutes or so, and then they're not allowed to speak anymore. And then the facilitator or the chair takes audience questions. So what was the best argument that you heard? What would have changed your view if they had said something? who came in with a fixed view? How did it change? And you saw that last part of that, and you have people who take turns standing up and speaking about how they reflected it, and then you watch people nod their heads or they think about it. The last part of it is people vote on who had the best argument and why. And so it's participatory in the truest sense of the word, because the audience vote wins. And you don't have to agree with the audience vote, and it doesn't mean that they've created a new thing that we all must adhere to now, but it's not just watching, it's actively engaging.
Who were the audience?
Incarcerated individuals,
okay, so
COs, program staff.
That adds even more value.
Yes.
Because now you have incarcerated individuals in the audience watching their possibly cellmate sitting up there.
Yeah.
And like
encouraging them.
Exactly. And not only that, but you're giving them other tools now, because men in prison have a tendency, you know, you all, like you said yourself, you have to display that masculinity for the most part, or you'll be looked at as weak.
Right.
So to give somebody an argument in a prison where you have to argue same-sex marriage, you know, now do I really want to do this? Because now I have to go back inside the prison, you know, and it might get around that I argued this.
That's right, and I was told many times that you could never argue same-sex marriage in prison, and I did it a number of
times.
I
would applaud the person who said, I'll argue it.
Well, that's right.
And, you know what I'm saying.
Sure, and those are the people that are, even if they don't, what I like is people that don't agree with it that are still willing to argue and volunteer to do so. So one of the things that's really important to do, and this goes to your point around safety, is saying at the beginning, people have been assigned positions to argue. They may not personally agree, but you're evaluating them on the best argument that they can make for this position.
Yeah.
And it's that cognitive dissonance of replacing that competitive desire to be right with the competitive desire to make the best argument that you possibly can.
Right.
It's like a law moot in many ways, right? But we're breaking it down and making it accessible to other people in different kinds of ways. But at its core, it's taking contentious issues and creating space for conversations for people to disagree and having that be okay. It's okay to disagree.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked about the model that you sort of created that, you know, was applied there but I think could be adapted to other communities was that it had these multiple approaches. So there was a development of curriculum that supported the debate club. So even though there's the five students on the debate club, the debate instruction was integrated into other parts of the AA program, into the GED program, especially the GED program.
Yes.
Work was really fascinating to me because that was reaching the entire a large subset of the population that wouldn't be affected by just the sort of debate training. But then also the sort of audience participation element was also really impressive and interesting to me because it wasn't just about having an audience to listen. The audience was really actively engaged in their own debate after the sort of debate club presented. So people were coming up with sort of written down arguments on pieces of paper and presenting them and debating with each other in a microphone. So it sort of opened up the space so that people who weren't in this club were also able to kind of engage in a more deep way with this conversation. And then they had that sort of opportunity then to vote on what they thought. And some of them changed their opinion even after the fact when they were in this sort of public debate. So that was sort of the interesting piece of it, that it wasn't kind of just focused on these individuals, that it was a really sort of integrated model that thought about how to expand beyond that. Mm-hmm. And I could see that being adapted beyond sort of a prison setting, like with another specific community or...
You also said that you wanted to take the competitive, you wanted to remove that part, that piece of it.
You can't remove it, because anytime you put people together, there is always going to be some element of that. But it's harnessing that drive toward a pedagogic purpose. Rather than just being right for right's sake, you have to be do your best within the model. And part of the model requires that you might have to argue against yourself. Part of the model means you can't just make up whatever you want. So one of the neat things for me was, and it was kind of frustrating, but in a good way, after some of these debate activities, I'd go to teach my class, and I'd have somebody go, what's your evidence for that claim? Well, what's the best argument against it? You know? So that was building expectations about what is it when somebody makes a truth claim? What is the basis for it? How is it justified? Right. Right, right. And you know, they might have been smiling a little bit at the same time, but that was good.
Did you ever see the debate that was done in Sing Sing here recently?
Uh-uh.
You might want to. They might want to YouTube that. That was Hudson Link, which is.
Oh yes, I know about Hudson Link's work. Yes,
they just did. It was either last year or the year before, and the actor Ice-T came into the prison, and he was one of the judges. And they had students come in, and it's in Sing Sing prison, you know. So something that you might want to look at too.
Yes, thank you.
I can really just speak to sort of how you could adapt it. I mean, I could see it sort of. I mean, going back to sort of what Gladys was saying about in the post-conflict setting, if there was sort of a youth-led group within a refugee camp, for example, and there was a community space, perhaps a community space could sort of develop resources to support a debate club that is being run but like by a group of youth in the refugee camp, and then they do public debates within the camp space. Something like that would be like a way of thinking about adapting it, like thinking about sort of where are these large spaces that OSF engages and how could you work with different partners within those spaces.
The challenge is finding those spaces.
Yes.
And finding NGOs working in those spaces that are interested in using this methodology without us necessarily telling them they have to, or I mean, because they'll get money from us if they do. I think there are a lot of complications about how it's going to work.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm also wondering about the flip, right? So we talked about the students going into the prison, which was, I'm sure, an incredibly enriching experience for the students. But the prisoners were still in prison, and the audience, which were incarcerated individuals as well. So I'm wondering about the flip. Like, what if you have students in the student setting pulling in people from these communities, whether it's prisoners or other kind of individuals, and having the debate there, your audience are the students. Mm-hmm. And you know, is that creating that space? Is it about, I mean... Are you getting the same kind of enrichment? It's depending on who your target is, right? Your target is trying to really target the incarcerated individuals, but if you're trying to target the students as trying to kind of get them to understand some of these issues around rights issues that they might not have been thinking about, do you need to bring those people into their space and have that space? I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to get my head about how you're doing
the same thing about like and all these scenarios and which. What's a model or a pilot or something we could try? And
I mean, because
how do we work it out?
It was very helpful for you to mention the point about being able to read, because I think in a lot of the prisons where we're working outside of here, literacy rates would be a lot lower.
Sure. So then, are we looking at other visual means of communicating? Key points. Are we thinking about other ways to support that learning so that they can participate? That becomes a way to jump into that later prize of participating in debate becomes building those skills to be able to learn, which they need to do anyway, right? I mean, which is needs to be a focus of whatever those populations are. I think about your point about we don't want to tell, you know, here's our great new debate model, now do it or you don't get any, right? I mean, that's I think one of the things that I'm really interested in is giving people options and letting them think through what the best option is for them. So the first debate, I would argue, in any project like this should we adopt this debate model? That's the first debate. And all you need is this book, because it tells you the competitive debate and it tells you this debate. People can decide for themselves the direction that they want to go. But it opens doors, and I think it goes back to this idea about we really want to make sure that we know what we're getting. But at the same time, there's that tension that part of the reflexive process is making room for mistakes, making room for things that don't work, making room for longer-term lessons that grow out of those initial steps. And I really think that that's an essential tension in international development. There's no way to get away from it. And yet, I do think there's a strength in the Soros model, in that we don't need to take one model and apply it everywhere. We need to take principles and encourage people to make those principles make sense to them in a practical way. And hopefully, I've been able to touch on how some of those things might be done.
those for us?
Yes, certainly.
Yeah, those are great. Yeah,
I was like, hand it over.
Please take them. Yeah,
please,
yeah.
Yes. One of the things that we do that I've done in the past is it's a debate on the role of higher education, and it's the first debate that debaters do. And there are articles there which we use to sort of generate arguments of fact, value, and policy, and then people get an opportunity to actually do it. And I will tell you that working with professionals, even in higher education, it's interesting to watch, because suddenly the old mechanisms that they use may not necessarily succeed anymore, and they've got to adapt themselves to the model. So when we're talking about equalizing the playing field and getting away from experts and learners, I think there's value there. I think the other piece of this one that's really good for low literacy folks is that we use concept maps and mind maps and these visual techniques of learning. And there's lots of evidence out there that even people who struggle with reading can succeed when we present information visually. And this doesn't have to detract from the quality of the information.
Have you ever seen it used in a group of people with intellectual disabilities?
I have not. But it'd be interesting to think about.
Can I ask you this, Doctor? If that's valuable, I recognize the value in that. But in preparing for debate, reading is not enough. You also have to know how to research.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we get that piece of it from visual? How do you teach that piece of it from visuals?
So one of the core starting points is you have to use credible sources. So the immediate question then is, well, what's a credible source? But then that allows for an opportunity for teaching about why the thing you found on your internet that some dude in their basement wrote last night may not be as good as something published in a peer-reviewed journal.
But we're not talking about reading. We're talking about a person who's not...
Critical thinking.
Oh, okay.
Right, and figuring out what information is credible is the first step. And so part of what I've tried to do is take away that you have to make a decision. If it's published in a credible source, it's good to go. It doesn't have to be the perspective I agree with. Provided that there's a legitimate source for that information, you're good. Some people don't like that, by the way, right? Because that means you could debate climate change. Because, like it or not, there are not very many, but a few peer-reviewed articles that doubt it. We've done the climate change debate in the prison. It's about letting the other side have its moment and not being afraid. I think one of the things that we're, and we see it right now with, I don't know how you feel about all these controversial commencement speakers and you know, people rising up and saying no, and we don't want them there. And I have a complicated relationship with this because I find honorary degrees really annoy me. We tell students that you have to spend all this money to get a degree, and then we just give them away to whoever. There's a bigger point about whether universities are still the place where people can have these difficult conversations. And I think one of the things that we can't do is push off certain kinds of speech or certain kinds of ideas and try to shuttle them away and try to pretend they don't exist, because then they grow. If you look at the United Kingdom right now and the UKIP party, people ignored them forever. And what are they doing right now? The most parties in the European Parliament from the United Kingdom are UKIP. And some of those folks, frankly, have ideas that could have been more, I think, effectively challenged if we let them in the debate initially. It's scary. It's scary, right? Because we have to let go of control. But I do think that if speech is good, it's good. And we need to create conditions by which even unpopular positions are debated. That demonstrates the sort of flexibility that we say we want other people to adopt in a very practical sense. It means some uncomfortable moments. But provided that we ensure that dialogue follows debate and that we be sure that we put what's occurring in that room in some sort of context, people come away with it with change perspective. We might not be able to change everybody's view through one debate, but at least we can give them the tools to consider why they think what they think.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot. That's a lot if we can succeed.
You asked a question earlier about how do you measure justice?
Mm.
And that's a good question, but the bigger picture is in terms of debate. Let's say we had NRA on one side, mm-hmm. and the Sandy Elementary School parents,
yep.
on the other side. Now we're talking about perspective here, mm-hmm. and now we're talking about justice.
Mm-hmm.
So justice for who? You know, for you, not justice for me. So that's the difficulty,
yeah.
in debate.
And you're getting at a core limitation of the model, which is that people have to be willing, the NRA member has to be willing to argue from the perspective of the Sandy Hook Elementary parent. And the parent has to be willing to argue from the NRA perspective.
So
that's very hard, and that's kind of the that's the point, right? It's that we've got to get away from this idea that just because we think it must automatically be correct. And one of the best ways to do it is by pushing people out of their comfort zone and arguing something they may not agree with. Because the process of coming up with a credible argument, even if they don't agree with it, will open them up to certain points of view.
So, but I think we need to move. For our work, I think we have to move beyond just opening
nuts and bolts, practical
points of view. Yes, very much. So, it has to not just suggest an opening of the other point of view or a new point of view, but to suggest action or limitations in the action that. In some of our grantees from these marginalized populations might be taking. Like, so in what ways can the opening up to another view or to the other side that they're not perhaps now questioning inform how they organize their work to make progress, whether it be on affecting whether or not unpopular legislation makes it through, the Kyrgyz parliament or something like that. So how, I think for me, that's the next step, is how do you translate that?
But I'm just wondering, sorry, Kimberly, you're like, we're having like a weird program conversation here and that you're all taking part in it. I am wondering, like, is if you can use it as a tool to create that accepting that there's another view and beginning to create the space, then does that create that space for then the NGO to actually come in and do some of their... Mm-hmm. some of their normal kind of work that they do. The problem is that normally our partners will do advocacy and nobody will listen to them and nobody will hear them, right? So do you use the debate as a tool to kind of open up the space so that then subsequently there's a greater chance?
But does it also change the way they do their tactics to make them more successful?
I hope so. Because like, it can't.
That'd be interesting if that works.
So it's the lawyer's answer, right? Before you go into court, you know the best argument on the other side. And you then tailor your argument to address what the biggest weakness is on your side or the biggest strength is on their side. So in terms of advocacy work, you need to know what that other perspective is. You may think you know, but the debate at least offers an opportunity to open up the discussion to where you might be able to say, oh, that's a sticking point. Oh, there's a problem. And then that might be able to inform where you put resources or how you design your next campaign or strategy. Not all law stuff is bad, it turns out.
I mean, I think a lot of it depends on what really your end goal is with the debate. I mean, a debate is, by the end of the day, a vehicle, and it's just where do you want it to take you. Mm-hmm. And
the system has detected that this conference has reached the duration limit for...
I didn't know we were on.
Well, start.
Nobody actually joined. A couple of people asked to join from Baltimore, but they didn't actually.
That was straight out of Star Trek. Beam me up now.
So I think we're coming to the end, though. Does anyone have any final questions? And
I have an abstract question, if
sure.
I may. I've been working a lot on books on various kinds of debate, and it seems that your model seems the most logical one because it emphasizes the need to acknowledge different perspectives. Have you ever thought of moving your model into the context of more academic forensic debate? Particularly at a lower level, like the high school level or junior high level?
I haven't. I guess the sticking point I worry is that the current infrastructure is so game toward this competitive model you know, the top schools in the country give out scholarships for it. There's a whole infrastructure in there. Do I wish that I could change the focus from this competition where people blah, 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 blah? I mean, YouTube some of these debates. It's unbelievable. Yeah. Where I have started to move into work is work in constitutional areas. So I've been surveying Canadian constitutional scholars since 2009 about the 2008 prorogation, which doesn't mean anything if you don't know about parliamentary politics, but it was essentially a coup d'etat in Canada. No one really... In Canada, things work in practice, but not in theory. And one of the thing that I've been looking at is how to frame those debates around the 2008 prorogation in a way that people will understand. Because just like in this country, Canadians are constitutionally illiterate. They do not understand their system of government. And one of my assumptions is if I can break out the arguments into a series of debates, you could use that as a civic engagement tool. Right now I'm starting a project with Samara Canada, who's been doing some of this stuff around civic engagement. And it's not debate per se, but it's creating, I have a paper coming out in the Review of Constitutional Studies where essentially I apply this model to 2008 and I identify four leading positions and two debates to have. And it's all the same stuff that's there. It's just applied to constitutional questions. So in Ukraine right now, there's an argument about whether what happened with the president, where essentially parliament essentially said, you're not the president anymore after the president had fled to Russia. Well, it seems to me that is another example of where this model could be useful. What are the leading arguments for parliamentary supremacy in that point of view? What are the leading arguments for executive authority under a presidential model? How do people understand that process? I appreciate the idea about applying it to youth, and I'm not opposed to it. I'm a little concerned that I don't, you know, this it's a pretty direct critique that I make on some of these traditional debate models, and I don't want it to be that I'm denigrating the work of people who are volunteering hours and hours and kids that are trying really hard. It's just I think that they're moving in a direction that undermines cooperative consensus building and rewards, you know, not everything is a baseball game. Not everything depends on the score. There are more important things, and debate to me is one of those things. So right now I'm based at the university and trying to encourage this debate as a way to start conversations between different populations. The debate, as you was said, I think very with great clarity, is it's a vehicle to begin other processes. But I appreciate the question. I'd love it. I'd love to make that happen.
Because what you would be doing is you would be training the best and the brightest of the classes. Those are usually the debaters. Not to attack, but think, acknowledge
right.
the other.
Right. And maybe this is something that we can do abroad, right? The Latvia debate program or other kinds of debate programs in other countries, especially with people that don't have the advantages that we do. Don't take some of these things for granted. Maybe there would be a willingness and an openness and an interest to start a more consensus-based participatory debate model. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for coming.